Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the second section of the fourth module of the History of Christianity 2 course. In the previous section, we looked at the first of two movements that happened as a result of the Protestant Reformation, that happened in response to the Protestant Reformation. We studied the Radical Reformation, the Anabaptists. The Radical Reformation wanted to reform more radically and or more quickly than Luther and the Swiss had. Now, in this section, we'll cover the other reaction to the Protestant Reformation. This movement is typically called either the Counter-Reformation or the Catholic Reformation. This group thought that Luther and the Swiss reformers went too far. They wanted to reject or reverse their reforms. Now, about the term Counter-Reformation, in one sense, this term is not accurate, because much of this movement happened before Luther. Remember, there had been people advocating for reform in the Roman Church long before Luther. Yet, in another sense, this term is accurate, because after Luther, much of the movement for reform was aimed in reaction to the Protestants. So in this section, we'll look at two parts of this larger movement corresponding to these two realities. And I'm going to describe this overall movement as Reformation without protest. We'll talk about many ways that this part of the church changed. It did reform, but it stayed within the Roman Catholic Church. That is, this movement did not protest against it or break from it like Luther, Zwingli, Calvin, and the Anabaptists had done. But first, we'll look at the timeline to put these people and events in the context of things we've already looked at in the previous history. Queen Isabella lived from 1451 through 1504, and her reforms began around 1495. Ignatius Loyola lived from 1491 through 1556, and the Society of Jesus was officially founded in 1540. Teresa of Avila lived from 1515 to 1582, and John of the Cross was 1542 through 1591, and the Council of Trent met off and on from 1545 through 1563. And then at the end of this section, we'll warp forward to look at one item that happened four centuries later, because this latter event is connected to the things we're examining in this section, and that is the Second Vatican Council, which took place from 1962 through 1965. Those are the names and dates. Now we'll explore their activity and significance in more detail. As I mentioned earlier, there were two main parts of the Catholic Reformation. There was an internal reform of practices. They took what they were doing seriously, and they tried to root out corruption and half-heartedness. And second, there was a reaction to external forces. That is, they reacted to Luther and the Protestants. An example of the first part was the Spanish Reformation under Queen Isabella and Cardinal Cisneros. This was the same Queen Isabella who sent Christopher Columbus to the New World. She and her husband, King Ferdinand, were examples of the rise of powerful monarchs in this period. In parts of the Middle Ages, the kings were weaker than the popes were politically, but that began to change, and so there were sovereigns who could now resist the power of the corrupted church. And that was basically the only thing that could bring about the reforms that everyone wanted. The institutional corruption had too many interests in keeping things the way they were to allow for reform. Queen Isabella and her religious advisor, Francisco Jimenez de Cisneros, made great strides toward correcting corruption and rooting it out of the churches under their authority in Spain. They took over some decisions about the church in Spain, taking that power away from Rome. They insisted that clergy and monastics live up to the ideals of their offices and remove those who continued in immorality or neglect of their duties. And they also made strides towards renewing learning along the lines of the humanist Erasmus. For instance, Cisneros founded universities and made the Bible more widely available in Greek, Hebrew, and Aramaic for study in the original languages. And this reform included the continuing impact of the Inquisition in Spain. We've already examined the Inquisition in the medieval period in the earlier history course, but this continued in Spain, and it aided the seriousness of the reform. Spain had only recently completed the expulsion of the Muslim invaders from its lands, and it worked to deport or convert those who still had Muslim sympathies. And the Inquisition was also turned against the Protestants, both in Spain and in other parts of Europe, and other minorities who would not convert to Christianity. The church in Spain was also impacted by mystic reforms of the monastic orders. Two of the primary leaders were Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross. They worked towards renewing the half-hearted monastic life back to wholehearted devotion. They did this through a return to the ideals of poverty and asceticism, but also through mystic practices modeled after the mystic experiences of their leaders. Now, let me explain what I mean by the terms mystic and mysticism. That is, what are the ideals and practices which these two people concentrated on? Well, they spoke about their visions and dreams, where they somehow had an immediate experience with God. Now, this kind of thing did occasionally happen in the Bible, where God revealed himself in this way. And there are also many examples of this kind of thing in pagan religions that came from false gods. We have no independent way historically to know exactly what Teresa or John experienced. We can only know what they told us. And they both put a lot of emphasis on their personal experiences with God and suggested others follow their example. I want to just suggest two principles that I think are helpful when we think about this kind of phenomenon. First is test everything by Scripture, and test these kind of experiences with the criteria that the Bible gives us to test these kind of things. And second, beware of making our experiences, whatever they are, more of a primary and functional authority than God speaking through the Bible. Our experiences are subjective and open to deception. The Scripture revelation is objective, and we can always go back to check what was actually written. Now, to be clear, I'm saying this as a general principle. I'm not trying to prejudice our understanding of Teresa or John one way or another. Because to be honest, I have not taken the time to read enough of either of them to form an opinion one way or the other. Teresa had visions and spoke of an enraptured love of God and prayer using the metaphorical figure of a castle, where prayer leads people from the outer rooms to the center chamber of complete intimacy with God. She wrote and counseled other monastics, attempting to teach people to pray in such a way as to have a deep, intimate encounter with God similar to what she had experienced. And John was recruited by Teresa to help in her monastic reforms. He also was a mystic, and he concentrated on embracing suffering. He coined a famous phrase, the dark night of the soul, as the title of a poem he wrote about his own experience of suffering and the testing of his faith that came through that experience. These two started new convents and monasteries, and their followers were known as the Descalced, which means barefoot, because they wore only simple sandals on their feet. This was an example of their rejection of luxury for poverty and simplicity. They embraced the ideals of monastic life from the Middle Ages that many of their contemporaries had rejected or ignored. And there is one final item I want to cover in terms of the internal reforms of the Roman Catholic Church at that time, and this will also transition to how the Roman Catholics responded to the Protestants. And this is Ignatius Loyola and the Society of Jesus, also known as the Jesuits, or the Jesuit monastic order. We already covered Loyola and the Jesuits a bit in the first history course in terms of monastic orders and the missionary expansion under Francis Xavier and others. But here I want to look at this order in terms of this section's topic. Ignatius Loyola was a Spanish nobleman who pursued a military career, but that was changed when he was severely injured by a cannonball. While he was recovering, he read the lives of the saints, and he apparently had a vision which led him to devoting himself to the Virgin Mary. In his own words, he determined to be a soldier for Christ with the same discipline and loyalty as his earlier military career. Later, as a student in Paris, he gathered a group of fellow students around him, and that was the start of the Society of Jesus, which was later officially recognized by the Pope as a new monastic order. They took vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience to the Pope. In his book, The Spiritual Exercises, Loyola taught his followers certain disciplines and practices as their basic training for spiritual growth, such as prayers, meditations, and the practice of visualizing themselves as living at the time of Christ and observing Jesus firsthand. And like I mentioned, the Jesuits became a missionary force with military-like discipline. And part of that discipline was unquestioned obedience to the Pope. Rule number 13 of the spiritual exercises says, "We must hold fast to the following principle. What seems to be white, I will believe to be black if the hierarchical church so defines it." In other words, they had the principle that a good soldier will unquestionably obey orders, and the Pope and the Roman Church organization were the authorities that they intended to obey. And the Jesuits also had an ideal similar to the idea that the end justifies the means. So some Jesuits thought they could do apparently evil things if it advanced the cause of the church. The Jesuits basically became the zealots of Roman Catholicism. And today, they are the largest monastic order in the Roman Catholic Church, with over 20,000 members in over 100 nations. And the Jesuits also became a missionary force working against Protestantism. They started colleges training Jesuits and other Roman Catholics for that purpose. And that does transition us into the second part of the Catholic Reformation. That is the part that is more accurately called the Counter-Reformation, because this was a reaction in resistance to what the Protestant reformers had done and were continuing to do at that time. First, I need to note that at the beginning of this period, there were two main factions within mainstream Roman Catholicism. The first were called the Spirituali, under the leadership of Cardinal Contarini. This group wanted to work with the Protestants and bring the church back together. They agreed with and wanted to implement some of Luther's reforms, and some even agreed with Luther on justification. But the other faction was called the Zelanti, which translates as the Zealots, under the leadership of Pope Paul IV. This group also wanted reforms, but in the direction of going back to medieval traditions, strengthening them, and rejecting and suppressing all of what they called the Lutheran heresy. And this latter group and their goal of rejecting Protestant influence had won the debate by 1542. And from that time on, almost the entire official Roman Catholic Church was united in the rejection and resistance to the Protestant Reformation. There were a few ways that the Roman Church expressed its resistance to Protestantism. The first was prohibiting certain books, because the Protestants had taken advantage of the recently invented printing press and used books to spread their ideas. In 1559, the Pope issued the first official list of prohibited books. This list included those books which the church did not allow its people to print, buy, or read. And what is noteworthy is that these kind of lists of prohibited books included common language Bibles. And they also included some writings of the church fathers, which were still officially recognized and agreed with by the Roman Church. But because the Protestants were using those fathers to teach Protestant doctrines, their books were forbidden as well. And the second reaction was the widespread use of the Inquisition. The Roman Church saw its effectiveness in Spain, and it became used in other countries like Italy against the Protestants. The Inquisition included torture and even death for those accused of being heretics. And the Inquisition at that time pursued all Protestants as heretics, and many were martyred for being Protestant. However, the defining element of the Roman Catholic reaction to the Protestant Reformation was the Council of Trent. Leading up to that time, there had been a series of popes, many of whom were not interested in anything but power, and some were very corrupt. There was a power struggle between popes and emperors and kings. The emperor wanted to call a council to deal with Luther and the Protestants, but internal fighting prevented it for a while. And there were many in the Roman Church who feared a council because that might bring the kind of changes which would root out the corruption. And they feared that kind of change and rooting out of corruption because they were corrupt and wanted to keep things the way they were. And therefore, they successfully fought to delay a council for quite a while. Pope Paul III finally called a general council at a town called Trent in northern Italy in December of 1545. This took place at Trent because it was neutral ground between the Pope and the Emperor. Paul III was corrupt, and he did not implement any of the changes that were suggested. But the council met off and on, mostly off, for almost 20 years. It lasted until 1563 under Pope Pius IV. The stated goal of this council was rooting out of heresy and the reform of conduct. That is, its purpose was twofold: to work against the Protestants and to reform the behavior of the clergy. The Council of Trent basically discussed every issue of theology that was raised by the Protestants, and they rejected all of them. Some items of medieval theology that had only been traditional before that time became official at the Council of Trent, and this was in reaction to Protestants who had questioned or rejected those particular portions of traditional teaching. For example, in the medieval period, the relationship of scripture and tradition was not officially defined. Even though Roman Church tradition was given authority, there was no official declaration of the reason why. But in response to the Reformation idea of sola scriptura, church tradition was officially defined as an authority in the Roman Catholic Church at the Council of Trent. And the uniformity of the church was solidified as the unquestioned norm. In other words, the Roman Church more strictly defined and regulated the life and worship of all churches under its authority, so that every doctrine and practice was the same for all Roman Catholics. The message of the Council of Trent was basically, it's the Roman Catholic way, or, well, no other choice was given. This is the way you will do it. And the Council of Trent set the tone for the Roman Catholic Church until the latter part of the 20th century. Now, let me give you a taste of what the Council of Trent decided and formally decreed. On the topic of Scripture, they said, the purity itself of the gospel be preserved in the church, and seeing clearly that this truth and discipline are contained in the written books and the unwritten traditions, the church receives and venerates with an equal affection of piety and reverence all the books, both of the Old and New Testament, seeing that one God is the author of both, as also the said traditions preserved in the Catholic Church by a continuous succession. So they said that Scripture and tradition are two equal authorities. However, as we saw in the History of Christianity 1 course, that kind of tension cannot hold for any length of time. Like Jesus said, you cannot serve two masters. One will always win out over the other. So we need to ask, which is the primary authority, Scripture or tradition? Which is the functional authority, the Bible or the Pope? It is always important to guard our primary functional authority. And the council also declared that the Latin Vulgate is the only authorized version of the Bible. And this, of course, discouraged or even forbade translations in the common languages of the people, like the Protestants had provided. And then, on the topic of justification, the council said, without any merit existing on their parts, they are called that so they, who by sins were alienated from God, may be disposed through his quickening and assisting grace to convert themselves to their own justification by freely assenting to and cooperating with that said grace. And if anyone says that by faith alone the impious is justified, in such wise as to mean that nothing else is required to cooperate in order to the obtaining the grace of justification, and that it is not in any way necessary that he be prepared and disposed by the movement of his own will, let him be anathema. Now, the word anathema means cursed. So anyone who doesn't agree with this pronouncement, anyone who basically believes sola fides, which would include all Protestants, was rejected and cursed by the Council of Trent. And the Council also said about justification, if anyone says that men are justified either through the imputation of Christ's righteousness alone or through the remissions of sins alone, let him be anathema. And if anyone says that the justice received is not preserved and also increased before God through good works, but that the said works are merely the fruits and signs of justification obtained, but not a cause of the increase thereof, let him be anathema. And then, on the topic of the sacraments, the Council of Trent pronounced, if anyone says that the sacraments are more or less than seven, baptism, confirmation, the Eucharist, penance, extreme unction, order, and matrimony, or that any of these seven is not truly and properly a sacrament, let him be anathema. And if anyone says that the sacrament of the new law are not necessary unto salvation, and that without them men may obtain to God through faith alone, let him be anathema. And if anyone says that in the Roman Church, which is the mother and mistress of all churches, there is not the true doctrine concerning the sacrament of baptism, let him be anathema. And then, if anyone says that the satisfaction by which penitents redeem their sins through Jesus Christ are not a worship of God, but traditions of men, which obscure the doctrine of grace and the true worship of God and the benefits itself of the death of Christ, let him be anathema. The Council of Trent clearly reaffirmed the ideas of transubstantiation in opposition to the Protestants. And then, on the topic of marriage, Trent pronounced, if anyone says that clerics constituted in sacred orders or regulars who have solemnly professed chastity are able to contract marriage, let him be anathema. And on the topic of indulgences, they said, whereas the power of conferring indulgences was granted by Christ to the church, and she has, even in the most ancient times, used the said power delivered unto her of God, the sacred holy synod teaches and enjoins that the use of indulgences for the Christian people most beneficial and approved of by the authority of sacred councils is to be retained in the church. And it condemns with anathema those who either assert that they are useless or who deny that there is in the church the power of granting them. In granting them, however, it desires that, in accordance with the ancient and approved custom in the church, moderation be observed, lest by excessive facility ecclesiastical discipline be enervated. And being desirous that the abuses which have crept therein, and by occasion of which this honorable name of indulgences is blasphemed by heretics, be amended and corrected, it ordains generally by this decree that all evil gains for the obtaining thereof, whence a most prolific cause of abuses among the Christian people has been derived, be wholly abolished. Now, in plainer language, they defended the use of indulgences and rejected the Protestants' complaints against them, but warned that indulgences could be and had been abused and therefore should be guarded against abuse. This pronouncement is interesting in that it clearly rejects the Protestant position while subtly admitting that indulgences had gotten out of hand and the Protestants had something to complain about. So it partly agreed with the Protestants without admitting that it agreed. The council also reaffirmed the traditional doctrines of purgatory and the intercession of saints, that is, the medieval system of merit. And in its last session, the Council of Trent also addressed issues of corruption, such as simony and clerical sexual immorality, almost as an afterthought. So, if you read through the documents of the Council of Trent and compare them with a typical Protestant confession, it kind of seems like they went down the list of what Protestants believed and rejected all of them, echoing the same language that the Protestants had used and then cursing anyone who believed that. Now, at first, even among Roman Catholics, the response to the Council of Trent was mixed. Some agreed, but some rejected their conclusions at first. Some of the rejection was for political reasons, but some thought they went too far in rejecting some good things the Protestants taught. But eventually, all Roman Catholics affirmed the Council of Trent as official Roman Catholic doctrine. And so the Council of Trent ended any hope of Protestants and Roman Catholics reuniting the Church of Europe, similar to the Great Schism hundreds of years earlier. This basically finalized the break between the Protestant and Roman Catholic churches. It made abundantly clear that Protestants and Roman Catholics don't believe the same things. Of course, there's always been a lot of overlap and agreement in some doctrines, but there are significant differences as well. They're certainly not the same. Those are the two main movements of the Catholic Counter-Reformation: some movements of reform within the Roman Church, and a firm rejection of Protestantism. Now, I want to say just a brief word of evaluation. And the best phrase I can think of in evaluation of the Counter-Reformation is, it depends. It all depends on if the Protestants were right or if the Roman Catholics were right. It depends on the truth and or godliness of the things they wanted to reform toward and the things they wanted to move away from. To the extent that they reformed from the bad toward the good, obviously that was good. But to the extent that they rejected the good and affirmed the bad, that was bad. So to evaluate the Counter-Reformation, we would need to evaluate all the doctrines and practices that they affirmed and or rejected. However, that does not yet get us to the core of the issue, because in order to evaluate all the doctrines and practices, we need to ask about the primary functional authority used in that judgment. This is really the main issue in this overall debate at that time, and it is a central issue for our lives as well. If our primary functional authority is in popes or councils or traditions, then our authority is only as good as the quality of the popes or councils or traditions, and none of them are perfect. But if our ultimate authority is God speaking through His inerrant word, then our authority is sure and certain. So choose your ultimate authority carefully. Now finally, I want to fast forward 400 years or so after the Council of Trent. Earlier I said that the Council of Trent set the tone for the Roman Catholic Church until the latter part of the 20th century. Now I want to talk about an event in the latter part of the 20th century which changed that. And this is the Second Vatican Council, which is also known as Vatican II. There certainly was a lot of history in the Roman Catholic Church in the meantime, which we can't cover in this survey course. But in all of that history, the Roman Catholic Church officially continued along the course set by the Council of Trent until Vatican II, which then made some changes. Therefore, Vatican II was the most influential event in the Roman Catholic Church since the Council of Trent. The Council was called by Pope John XXIII in 1959. Now, it was not called for the purpose of making changes, but there was enough desire for change within the Roman Church that this Council basically snowballed into the reworking of many positions that had stood for centuries going back to the Council of Trent. And as a result, there were many adjustments to the Roman Catholics, which included changes in the Mass, the liturgy of the Church. As a result of Vatican II, they now allowed a greater variety of worship forms and rituals, changed to fit local cultures, and not a one-size-fits-all standardization. And for the first time, the Mass was allowed to take place in the local languages instead of only in Latin. And so there were local variations in the liturgy and ceremony. Vatican II said, if certain locales traditionally use other praiseworthy customs and ceremonies when celebrating the sacrament, this sacred synod earnestly desires that these by all means be retained. So, for example, the Mass in Hong Kong could now be different from the Mass in South America, reflecting the local customs in each place. And overall, this made the liturgy more accessible and meaningful to the people, especially the use of the common language. But I think the most dramatic change was that the Church finally became open to the people reading the Bible in their native languages. The Church relaxed their earlier insistence that the ordinary people be discouraged from reading the Bible for themselves, and then only allowed to read it in Latin. So as a result of Vatican II, the Bible was officially allowed to be read in the various local languages. And along the same lines, there was much more openness to the involvement of the people of the Church, and some decentralization away from everything being done and controlled by the clergy and church hierarchy. One priest who was involved in Vatican II said, "The greatest legacy of the Council was the empowerment of the laity and the corresponding reduction in the relative power of the clergy and the magisterium." Notice that these issues reflect some of the same issues that we saw raised by the Protestants. And a lot of these changes may sound familiar. They're some of the same changes that Luther had made 4 centuries earlier, without a hint of acknowledging that Luther may have been right to give the Bible to the people in their native language and empower the laity. Some of the changes look very similar to the concept of the priesthood of believers. However, Vatican II changed the customary practices of the Roman Catholic Church to a certain extent, but they still upheld the traditional Roman Catholic doctrines, including those solidified in rejection of Protestantism. And they continued to insist that the Roman Catholic Church is the one true church. So Vatican II changed some of the practices, but not the theology of the Roman Catholic Church. There was, and still is, some resistance to the changes of Vatican II among the Roman Church. And so, how much it will change and how much it will remain traditional is still to be seen. But the Second Vatican Council certainly was a momentous event for change in that church. Now, let's review. We can summarize the Catholic Counter-Reformation as Reformation without protest. They changed some things while also strengthening loyalty to the official Roman Church organization. And there were 2 parts of this movement: internal reform and a reaction to external forces like the Protestants. Some key people we studied were Isabella and Cisneros, who worked against corruption in the Spanish Church, and Ignatius Loyola, Teresa of Avila, and St. John of the Cross, who pioneered new monastic orders to renew the seriousness of the monastics in the Church. The main event in the Counter-Reformation was the Council of Trent. This insisted on uniformity of the Church and a strong rejection of Protestantism, a rejection of its doctrines and a rejection of its practices, which worked out into a rejection and persecution of Protestants wherever they were within the reach of Roman Catholic authorities. And finally, centuries later, the Second Vatican Council allowed for some changes in the practices of Roman Catholic worship without changing any of the traditional theology. And that brings us to some discussion and application questions. First, what was good and worthy of imitation in the Catholic Reformation? What did you notice from either the internal Reformation or the reaction to the Protestants that you thought was good and true and right? And why? What was good about it? And how can you learn from and imitate the good you saw? And what was bad and should be avoided in the Catholic Reformation? What did you notice that you thought was wrong or false or misguided or unwise? And why? What was bad about it? And how can you learn from and avoid a similar problem in your own life? In what ways do you expect to apply this insight in your own life and ministry? Second, what did you learn about how to respond to issues in your own group which you think you need to change? This is similar to a question from the last few modules about how to do Reformation well. What did you learn in this section that would help you to be wise and effective in bringing about needed Reformation and change? What did you learn in the section about what to avoid doing? Describe some principles and insights that you've gained and how these things will inform and change what you will do. And third is a similar question. What did you learn about how to respond to outsiders with whom you disagree? What did you learn from how the Roman Catholics responded to the Protestant Reformation, good and or bad? What principles can you use to help you respond rightly whenever you're confronted with someone else disagreeing with you or a position you hold? What are some good ways to respond that you've learned and should imitate? What are some bad ways to respond that you should avoid? How can you apply what you've learned? And last is the general question, what else did you learn and how does it apply? Here's where I will pause for discussion. Feel free to take as much time as you need to think through and talk about these issues and questions. And then, when you're ready, come back and we'll look at some guiding principles from this section. So, pause the video now. Okay, we're back and ready to look at some guiding principles that we can learn from studying the Catholic Counter-Reformation. The first is just to remind you of some of the general principles from the previous sections, which still apply to this section's material. I'll just list them as a reminder, and if you need to refresh the definition, you can review the previous section. We should distinguish the core from the peripheral, pick your battles. We should change wisely, which sometimes means change slowly and carefully. We should initiate change with truth and convincing people, not through coercion, manipulation, or violence. We should test everything and keep Scripture as your primary functional authority. Those are just a review of some good principles that still apply to this section as well. The second principle is that we should be humble and open-minded. It is easy to look at the Council of Trent and conclude that they didn't give even Luther's ideas even a chance. They were so convinced that they were right and the Protestants were wrong, and that's basically the end of it. Well, the history is more complicated than that, but there's some truth in that kind of conclusion. But even if that were the attitude they had at that time, we have no ground to look down on them, because we are just as liable to do the same thing, and we should guard against it. We should all be humble and suspicious of our own ability. None of us are without error. None of us have God in our back pocket. Every one of us suffers from the blinding effects of arrogance, prejudice, and sin. So we should be open to being corrected when appropriate. And yet, at the same time, we need to be discerning. We should not be open to everything. We should not believe anything and everything. I don't need to give a full and complete hearing and thorough consideration to those who advocate for genocide or pedophilia. Nope, I'm not going to go there. There are some things we should not even consider. There is a wisdom to be open and humble where appropriate, and a wisdom of being skeptical and closed where appropriate. Our minds should not be so open that our brains fall out, but neither should we be so arrogant that we cannot learn and grow. And related to that is the next principle. that we should not be blindly reactionary. We should not let ourselves get caught up in a pendulum swing of rejecting everything that the other side says and does just because the other side said or did it, so that we become just as unbalanced in the opposite direction. There are people today who are known more by what they are against than by what they are for. And we should never let our enemies set our agenda or our beliefs, even negatively. That means we should reject what is untrue and bad about our enemy's position, but we should also agree with whatever is true and good about what they believe. And we don't believe it because they believe it. We believe it because it's true. And we don't reject something because they accept it. We reject it because it's false. Our driving authority is not just to reject someone else's position or practices. Our driving authority and goal is to conform ourselves to the truth as God has revealed it. We compare ourselves and measure ourselves by God's truth and not by the people around us, neither those on our side nor those on the other side. So don't swing the pendulum from extreme to opposite extreme, but aim for what is right and try to stay there. The next principle is a concept I call priority and proportion. This is related to the idea of picking your battles and theological triage, which we addressed in the last section. There are some things that are more important and more urgent than others. Some things are core, some are peripheral. Some things should be more of a priority in our lives. But that does not mean that the top priority should get 100% of our time and attention. There are also other things that, even though they're not most important, still deserve at least some of our attention. From the illustration of triage, the guy who's about to die should see the doctor before the guy with a broken arm. However, the doctor should eventually get around to healing the guy with the broken arm. We should divide our time and energy in the right proportion. There might be an issue that is true and important, but only warrants, say, 5% of our time and energy. But if we give that thing 50% of our attention, then we're out of proportion. And God speaking through Scripture should be our authority in determining priority and proportion. There are some things that are in the Bible and are important, and so we should take them seriously. But if the Bible only mentions them a small proportion of the time, we should not give them more of our proportion than the Bible does. We should not neglect other things that the Bible gives more emphasis for the sake of things that are given less priority. Like Jesus said, people can strain out the gnat and swallow the camel. We should let God determine which battles we engage, which battles we ignore, and which percentage of our ability we give to each fight. We should ask God to guide our priorities and the proportion of our life we give to each priority. And the last principle I want to suggest is that when someone resorts to censorship, that is a pretty clear sign that they have a losing argument. Remember, at that time, the Roman Catholic Church prohibited certain books, including the Bible. But those who have the truth are not afraid to hear falsehood. Those who have the truth are not afraid to defend it. Because the best antidote to falsehood is the truth. And the best way to stop a bad idea is to bring it into the light and compare it with a better idea. So if someone tries to censor their opponent, it usually shows that they're not confident in their own position. Censorship is almost always bad, and there is a very good reason that freedom of speech was included in the Bill of Rights. However, I do need to qualify that somewhat, because there's a difference between censorship and listening to what people have to say. Their right to speak does not mean that I have to listen, and they don't necessarily have the right to speak at any time and in any place. For example, imagine I'm teaching a history class and someone interrupts in order to talk about hockey. Now, for the record, I like hockey, and I think this guy should feel free to talk about hockey all he wants on his own time. But in the middle of a history class, I would tell him to sit down and shut up, because he's dishonoring all the other students who pay to learn about history in that class at that time. In other words, we have a right to speak, but we have to earn the right to be heard. And in our culture, unfortunately, I also have to point out that keeping porn away from children is not censorship. It's not book banning. It's the bare minimum of acceptable parenting. It's just a clear sign of sanity. And it's also a very conclusive test to weed out those kind of people who should never be trusted around kids. Now, one final thing I need to say. Some speech really is hateful. And yet, the concept of hate speech should be rejected. Usually that phrase is just code for speech that someone hates and wants censored. But what right does someone have to decide and tell everyone else what is hateful and what is not? They are trying to take a right for themselves that they are refusing for others. And even speech that is genuinely hateful should be allowed to be spoken in order to prove that it is hateful, and so that those who say it will be shown for what they are and hopefully be ashamed and shunned and proved wrong by comparison with someone else speaking the truth in love. Now, there's a whole lot more I could say on this topic, but I'll stop here and summarize the point. In general, those who want to censor others are often proving that their argument is weak and does not stand up to the challenge. Now, as usual, the history of this era and the variety of the Roman Catholic responses is larger than we could cover. I encourage you to dig and explore deeper on your own if you're so inclined. But I hope you now have at least a survey overview of the concepts and events of the Catholic and Counter-Reformations. And I pray that God has given you insight into the relevant principles that you can learn from this to live more wisely in your own time and situation. In the next module, we'll look at the last historical events that make up the Protestant Reformation. And this is the separate but related changes that happened in England and the English Church, around the same time as the reforms we've already studied. And I'm excited just thinking about it. Thanks for watching.